Well, welcome back to Action RC, the podcast series taking you inside RC racing now and over the 40 years of its history. Before we dive into today's show, a quick mention of the Extra Lap RC podcast. It's one of my favorites. Last week, I joined Aiden, Martin, and Joey for a chat. They're a great crew, and it was really fun to chat with them. So let me encourage you to have a listen to that episode, but also all the Extra Lap shows. If you haven't listened to them, some really good insights into the UK and European race scenes, particularly focused on 10 scale off-road. That's Extra Lap RC. Great bunch of guys, and shout out to them. Now, today's show, we're going to do something a little bit different as we bring the first in a very irregular series of race recaps. We all know that race results are pretty easy to find these days, and race footage is often live or very quickly available. So we're not going to try and recap what actually happened at the race or the results, but to dig into the story of the race a little bit, what it was like to be there, the things we've noticed about the race, the stories we're intrigued by, those kinds of things. We're going to try and bring you our own Action RC style of race recap, a bit of analysis. If you like it, let us know. If you don't like it, then don't let us know. Oh, no, you can let us know, but gently. So today, 2023 Silver State, reckoned by some to be the biggest race of all time with something over 1,100 entries from 450-odd drivers. One of those was Australia's own Ben Stirling. A longtime eighth off-road racer, has raced all around the world, including previously getting to Silver State. And Ben's graciously agreed to join me for a bit of a chat through the Silver State 2023 race from a racer's perspective. Ben Stirling, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Scotty. Thanks for having me on board, mate. And it'll be great to talk about the Silver State race that we just got back from over in the USA.
Big trip from Australia. So just before we get into any of the details, what's the kind of travel time from home to Vegas where the race took place?
So we were lucky enough to get a flight direct from Brisbane to LA itself, which is okay. A 13 and a half hour flight.
Yeah.
So that was good. So saves any layovers and all that stuff around. So we spent a couple of days in California, and then we just drove across in our high car to Vegas, which is about a 4.5 hour drive. So pretty easy going.
Yeah. Fair enough. Now, listen, before we dive into the Silver State story, let's just introduce you a little bit to the show. We've not chatted on the show before. So without going into all the details, what's your RC story? How'd you get started? Where's your home track? You know, what's the kind of Ben Stirling story?
So basically I started off RC racing when I was probably 13 years old down in Melbourne, Victoria, which is where I grew up. And then it was actually my first ever job. I was actually in a mower shop, and a little offside business to their mower shop was a hobby shop. So I got involved with those guys and worked there every Saturday. And then obviously through school holidays and things like that, just earn a bit of extra money. And then the whole radio control thing sort of took me fancy.
Oh, it took
off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And grabbed a car from there. And then they started up their own club, which is still going to today, which is On Road. And then, here we are today. So 23 years later, whatever it is. So
it hasn't always been 8 scale for you. You've done a bit of other stuff as well.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I've pretty much tried every form of class in RC now in surface stuff. But, yeah, my home is 1/8 scale off-road. It's something I always wanted to do growing up, and now I'm fortunate enough to be able to have the sponsors and backing on board to be able to make it happen, because it can be quite an expensive class to do it at the top level. As I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah. So you're now based in Brisbane, right? What's your home track here?
Correct. So we moved up here just on over 3 years ago, and then my local track here would be Logan Off-Road.
Okay, great. So there's a great scene, isn't there, in Southeast Queensland? Four really good racetracks: Logan, Pine Hills, host of the Asian Buggy Championship, Sunny Coast, Toowoomba, where you'll be in a couple of weeks. You're enjoying the scene up here?
Yeah, I'm loving it. And that was one of the big callings for me to get me up here with my family. So obviously RC is a big part of my life, as long as work. So we sort of made the move up here to catch the sunshine and get a bit of racing in. And then, you know, obviously the level of racing up here is quite high compared to everywhere else in Australia, I find. You know, like back in Victoria, we had sort of two or three fast guys. We're up here, everyone in the A-Main has a chance to win at every club day you're in. Yeah. So that's really cool to see and be a part of, you know, and it only makes us go faster, and you push each other to go faster. So when we go to those bigger events around the world or around Australia, we've got a fair chance of being up the top there somewhere, you know.
Yeah, nice. Now, I have a sense that you've also got some professional involvement in full-scale motorsport. You seem to be always hanging around speedway or motocross or those kinds of things. Am I close to the mark there? What's your connection with some of those parts of motorsport?
Yeah, you're pretty much bang on. So my working career up until I moved to Queensland was always in the motorcycle or motocross industry. So okay. I worked for some of the biggest teams as a mechanic on some of the biggest Honda and Suzuki factory teams as a mechanic, and then had a dealership for 7 years. And then once I moved to Queensland, I got involved in Speedway, which I always went and watched as a kid growing up, and
it's
as
awesome,
an adult even.
Yeah,
watching the Speedway. And then, yeah, my job now is basically selling parts to all the big sprint car teams around Queensland and Australia, and then following the Queensland series around and selling them parts of the track. So that's pretty cool.
Fantastic. I don't think you could find, I mean, you'd go a long way to find a better night of live motorsport than sprint cars at, you know, at the Speedway. It's incredible to watch.
It sure is.
Maybe Supercross. There's been some interesting developments in the Supercross as well over the last couple of weeks in the US as the season wraps up over there. But anyway, that's a different podcast, different topic.
Yeah.
So, mate, tell me, how did you – well, no, before we kind of leave that full-scale motorsport thing, what – you know, having worked in that industry and been around racetracks, what are the things that you notice that are comparable to RC motorsport compared with the full-scale kind of equivalent? Are there similarities? Are there big differences?
Obviously, there's big differences because of the actual scale of it and money side of it. And obviously, the crowd, you know, you won't have those sprint car events or motorsport events on without a crowd because they're the ones at the end of the day really funding this track or, you know, the event series that's held there for that weekend. So there is a bit of a difference in that side of things. But, you know, I suppose that's where I come in with the way I promote myself so well and the way I always have my cars looking the way they do at events because I've got that backing and that knowledge of how it goes in a full-size caper to try and bring it to RC and lift the game for us there. Because, you know, if we just sit in our little bubble all the time and we're never going to grow. So there is similarities, but it's just a matter of trying to implement them in RC to get us to there. So I find there is a massive difference with the way, you know, we can't get a crowd. You know, we struggle to get numbers at certain events and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, your full-scale motorsports, you know, these people find the money to do it. So, there is big differences.
So this is not really the topic for tonight's conversation, and maybe we'll do this another time. But, you know, the kinds of things you're saying there remind me a lot of, you know, the polarizing figure of JQ and some of the kind of stuff he's been saying around promotion of the sport and, you know, trying to get outside our own little bubble. And the RCGP series was a part of that. But there's been plenty of people talking about how we do a better job of putting on what we're doing so that we do kind of break out of our own tiny little industry.
Exactly.
Maybe we'll have a chat about that another time and kind of dig into that a little bit more.
For sure.
Yeah. So, mate, let's talk about Silver State. Why were you there? How did you come to make the trip? What is it about this race that kind of said to you, I need to fly halfway across the world to be at this race?
This year, well, previous years for me, it's always been to go and get results and, you know, try and get sponsorships and stuff like that and obviously watch the best races in the world race. But this year and last year for me, it just really needed a holiday. You know, my work is every weekend through summer for 8 months of the year and then I get 3 months off without having to work a weekend. So I really just needed that weekend or that week off as a bit of a holiday and sort of let my hair down a little bit.
And so what better way than 16-hour days at a racetrack to relax, right?
Exactly right. So I had a few beers, so that was good. And then got to race toy cars on the side, which was even better.
And there was a bit of a crew from Australia and New Zealand this year, wasn't there? It's been kind of coming over the last few years. But who else was there from, shall we say, down under from Australia and New Zealand?
So basically from New Zealand, we had Jaden Jamison come over. He's a techno driver from over there.
Yep.
And then from Australia, we had Caleb Noble from up north in Queensland, fellow techno driver.
Yep.
Alex Benadzik, who's a local guy here to me. Mm-hmm. And then he's an associated driver.
Yep.
And then we also had Paul Mason and Mark Andrew, who are also associated guys that are local here. And then Gavin White, who's actually my best friend from down in Melbourne. He came over as well and made the trek over.
That's a good crew. Did you hang out a bit together or were you kind of off with your own manufacturer teams or how did that work for you?
No, we all sort of get along pretty well. So, yeah, we obviously went our own ways to get there and things like that. Like we had Paul Mason and Alex and that on my same flight to get over there. And then Gavin just met us there because obviously he was flying out of Melbourne. But yeah, once we were there, we sort of all hooked up together, and Caleb was there a bit earlier than us. So, but obviously when you're at a Silver State event, you sort of try and always find your fellow Aussies and stuff, people that you know, you can hang around with and talk a bit of crap with, you know?
Yeah, familiar face. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly.
Well, we might come back a bit later on and talk about how everybody got on from down under, but let's talk about the big picture. 450-odd drivers, 1,100 or more cars. But for the thousands more of us who weren't there, and probably, you know, if we're honest, I'm never going to get to a Silver State race. So can you just give us a bit of a feel for what this race is like? Like, it's in a Vegas hotel, I think, but I don't really understand how that – what does it look like when you get there? How's the race kind of venue, and what is it all like?
So basically the hype of Silver State that you see online is the hype you get when you get there. You know, you get the butterflies in your stomach and you get the jitters that you just want to go racing and can't wait to just go and check out the track and stuff like that. But obviously you're arriving in a massive hotel, which is just on the Las Vegas Strip there, just a couple of blocks away from the actual proper part of the strip itself.
Okay.
And then, yeah, so you go and check into your hotel, you go get your room, which, you know, Joey does a great job with organising all that for everybody because you get an early discount code for your hotel as well, which can save you quite a few hundred dollars if you were to book with that code, you know. So booking with that code, you get your hotel room and you can literally, it's a 3-minute walk from your hotel room. So you go down to the bottom to the lobby, walk out through a little like a little fire emergency door and it walks up a hallway outside and then goes to a massive arena out there. Which is where they hold normally like horse events, so like equestrian and rodeos and dressage shows and all that sort of stuff in there. So the dirt is really quite fine, and powdery. And then it's basically a big, massive open shed basically with a Budweiser truck in there and a little food cart and stuff. And then dividing that big factory down the middle, or the shed down the middle, is a double-sided grandstand. So both sides can actually, you know, split the room up into two, basically, with that grandstand.
Yeah.
And then obviously one side is where they set up the driver stand and race control, and that's where your track is.
Yep.
And then over the back side of that is where your pits are. So you're all pitting under the same shed, same, you can hear the noise from the cars and everything. So you get all that involvement and atmosphere.
Fantastic.
And then you're basically and then everybody pits under there. So everyone has to pit inside. So everyone's together, you know, that have pit tents. Okay. So the whole vibe of, you know, it doesn't matter what team you're on, you're still in somewhat with each other, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Mingling with each other, walking past each other all the time, you know, talking, you know, it's a great bonding experience for RC people to get to, because these people that you go to like the dirt or something like that, it's just like tent city.
Yeah.
So everyone's in their little tents for their teams and stuff like that. And they only pretty much get out of their tent to go to the track and then come back. You know, there's not a lot of mingling and stuff like that with your big pro teams and everyone like that. So
there is something pretty cool about those sorts of races, isn't there, where everyone's pitting under the same marquee or in the room, and, you know, you can be two tables away from a world champion and it just feels like everyone's in it, as you say, like as you've described there really well, everyone's in it together.
Exactly. Yeah. No one's sort of left out, you know what I mean? Your big manufacturers are always welcoming of people to travel from overseas or within the country to come and join them. So the bigger the pits, in their area they've got, the better. It's all about obviously presentation and showing who's got the biggest team and who doesn't and whatever else, which is great to see. You know, RC needs that, and that bonding between everybody there to talk together and work as a whole rather than individual, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, that makes me kind of think about some things. One is that, you know, there's 450 guys there, or guys and girls, whatever the number exactly is. And, you know, we've heard of 50 or 60 of them, but 400 we haven't. So if you're, you know, if I'm Scott Guide and I show up at the Silver State, you know, with my, I'm currently running a HB 8-scale buggy, you know, am I going to be able to go and talk to these guys and the teams and get some ideas on setup? Are people pretty good at welcoming the kind of, you know, the people no one's ever heard of that are running in the sportsman classes? Is there a good vibe like that?
Oh yeah, 100%. You know, if you even needed a part or something like that, you could go over and ask any one of those people at those tables, and they'll help you straight away. That's another great point about it is those people are always willing to help. You know, it is at the end of the day their job for a lot of them.
Yeah.
As you know, USA is huge for full time races. I think, you know, everyone in that A main pretty much was on a full time wage to race from regular draw cars. And then they're mostly from, you know, USA or Asia, Europe, sorry. You know, they're all willing to help. So if you go over there, they're all approachable. You know, a lot of them, it's Vegas, they're there to party and enjoy themselves too. You know, a lot of them you'll see they're sitting there at the table having a beer while they're wrenching on their RC car, ready for their next qualifier or next race to go out to. So it's a really laid back, you know, let your hair down sort of event where you can go and enjoy yourself and not have that, oh, I really need to go and ask someone for a bit of help. I'm a bit lost here. I don't want to go and ask him because I'm just going to annoy him, you know, or her. So it's a really good thing to do and you be a part of it in that way for sure.
Nice. How well organized is, you know, an event? I mean, to run an event for 1,100 plus entries over the 4 or 5 days must have a pretty reasonable level of organization. You're always aware of what's happening and in terms of race schedules and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so you got pretty much the three best race callers in the world. You got Jimmy Babcock, who does all the JBRL races. He does pretty much all Joey's events in America. So he just runs on, you know, a Swiss watch. So pretty much you start the day at 7 a.m. in the morning. Oof. And there will be no delays. There's no waiting for marshals. There is literally, you start at 7 o'clock. The first race is on at 7 o'clock. If you miss your heat, you miss your heat.
Yeah.
You know, they're really good too if you obviously miss your heat for whatever reason or you need to leave early that day because you got to want to go and see a show down the strip or whatever. You know, they're really good. They'll call for a marshal to come and fill your spot. They're not going to penalise you and things like that. Whereas in Australia, you know, we're really strict on that with people marshalling, which, you know, you've got to be because it's fair is fair. But at a big event like that, you just got multiple people that you can fall back onto to fill those positions quite quickly, you know.
Yeah.
And I've got to give a shout out to Ryan Lutz for that one too, because he's the first person out there every single time as a pro driver to go and, you know, marshal, or he'll be there at 7 a.m. in the morning and they call him for marshal because all the pro guys aren't down there yet. So he's one of those people that is always out there marshalling. You know, it's really good to see for a person like that at that level to put in like the way he does. But yeah, so they just pretty much start at 7 a.m. in the morning and they will just push through until it gets done. So there is no delays. The only delays it would be for watering, which for some reason this year they watered every third heat, which was crazy. So the track was always damp for pretty much everybody on the track, whereas last year and the previous years it always started to get a bit of a groove there and we actually ended up on like soft or soft long wear tyres there. But this year we just stayed on pretty much super softs the whole time.
So let's kind of talk about the track itself then. You know, you spoke before about this, the room being, or the building being used for equestrian events. So there's real limitations, aren't there, in terms of not being able to treat or do anything with the kind of dirt there, which kind of lends the track to its characteristic of kind of being famously rough and changing really constantly. Is that the story? Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. And then also it comes down to the point where with your piping, you can't even peg your piping down there. Mm. So they actually use sandbags cable tied to the pipe to hold the pipe in its position. You know, so you've got to worry about your pipes too, because the pipes move, especially on like undulating sections, you know, where it's a tight apex.
Yeah.
The pipe will move because people hit it and all the sandbag will move and then it actually lifts up so you can get your car jammed under there. Because obviously horses need to use it. And some of these horses that use that venue are $1 million horses. So they can't afford to have like a stake or a peg or...
Yeah.
You know, unknown substance added to the dirt that can get an infection in a foot or whatever, you know, that needs to be left very, very clean.
So we're not adding glue or sick surface or, you know, sump oil or anything to the dirt there, are we? We're running it kind of just straight with water and away you go.
Straight with water, and they roll it every night and prep it every night.
Yep.
But that's all you get. So pretty much your first heat on the track gets a nice smooth track every day.
Yep.
And then after that, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So as a person that runs in the pro class, you know, for us, we never get a smooth track. It's always rough. You know, even from the very first day, you'll get a track that's starting to get bumps in the corners and after the jumps and stuff like that, which is all part of the, you know, the skill level that these guys have, that they can adapt to those conditions. For us that come from overseas that never get to do anything like that, it gets quite difficult, which is, you know, why we'll struggle to go so well over there. But it's one of those things you need to learn to adapt, and that's what those pro guys can do really, really well, because they do it day in and day out. And that's what, you know, part of the attraction is to go into those events, is to see them, how they can just go from smooth track to a rough track with conditions like that and adapt themselves and their car so quickly, you know.
I think you raised a really interesting point there, Ben, and I just want to dig into that a little bit if we can, because on the one hand, you look at a race like Silver State and you go, well, this is actually neutral territory. No one's ever driven on the track before. No one's, you know, everyone's had the same amount of practice. But if you're a driver who does those kinds of races all the time, on a fresh track all the time, I'm guessing you build that skill set of being able to learn a track really fast and, in a sense, anticipate the way that it might change, you know, over the qualifying rounds, for example. Whereas if you do all your racing on a, you know, on permanent racetracks that don't change so much, that might be a skill set that you don't have. And so, you know, whilst it is neutral territory, I wonder if that's what actually does give, say, the US drivers, for example, a bit of a home track advantage in that they're used to running these one-off temporary track kind of events. Is that how it feels as a racer yourself?
Yeah, I reckon for sure. You know, in Australia, we're very fortunate to have prep tracks every single time we head out. You know, every time you go to, like Logan, you look at them for an example, you go there every club day, they're, you know, Graham and them are out there on the rolling the track for us and filling in the holes. And, you know, and unfortunately in Australia, we've got a lot of club guys that won't race because there's a bump on the corner or something like that. They say, oh, it's just too rough. You know, it's just like, and I sit there and think, you know, like, well, you've got to try and drive on these tracks to get better and go fast, you know, because you will end up one day at an event, you know, where it's a trophy race or something like that, where the track's going to, you know, gain some character, as they say, and you're going to need to adapt. And then that's when you start going backwards, is because you haven't had that chance to ever adapt to know what your car does. So the USA guys can really pick that straight away. You know, they're racing PMB and SICK and all these events where they're in these stadiums, whether it's a track that's never there during the day or the week, and they build it for that event. So the jump faces are always very similar, and surface will always deteriorate the way it does. Obviously, different dirts work in and deteriorate different ways, but Silverstate, they've raced, you know, indoors for 5 years now, I think it is. So they know what to expect, and, you know, even down to the temperature in there, they've got the air conditioner just cranking inside because they need to get the fumes and dust out of the venue, because it's bad enough in there as it is without that, let alone, you know, being in there hot. So they've got the air conditioners pumping in there. So that all makes a big factor as well, you know, because at night it cools down outside, which means it gets even colder inside with the aircon going. So, you know, you're constantly changing diff oils and shock oils and things like that to adapt. And that's what these American guys can do so well, is they can read the temperature, they can read what the track's doing, they can read what the tire needs to do. And then they'll make the change for the next qualifier. And there is that much time in between each run that they have time to do all those events, you know. And I was pitting quite close to Tessman this year in Silverstate. And you literally look at his bench all day, every day, you know, for the whole 18 hours or whatever we're at the track, from 7 a.m. till 2 a.m. in the morning, he'll have his car apart in some way. Him and Gord will be wrenching on his car nonstop. And that's the difference of what we bring to the table, is, you know, I'm there to have a beer and race toy cars and, oh, I've got to change a shock. Oh, change the shock oils now, you know. Whereas they know it's a job. That's what they got to do to get results. And they'll have everything pulled apart after every run, changing something, making the car better and adapting to the car to the track. And that's the biggest difference to what we can bring, you know.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to edit this out, but I just changed the diff fluid in my car for the first time in 6 months. So, No, I'll leave that in. That's my confession to the world. So, you know, what sorts of things are you looking at, you know, in terms of staying on top of the track? Because it does seem like it, you know, that track and the bumps and the ruts and the holes are shifting around almost race by race. So, you know, are you out there watching, you know, half a dozen races before yours to see how things have evolved since your last time on track, and then making some last minute changes, or what how do you stay on top of it?
Yeah, that's normally what you do. I just want to try and go up, you know, five or six races before mine and watch the track for a heat or two, just to see where there's bumps and ruts starting to form and stuff like that. But as I said, this year I didn't really go over there for that. So I didn't really try too hard, to be honest, because I was over there for more of a holiday. But, you know, I was watching Caleb and Alex, especially those guys were up there, was watching what was going on with the track, and you could see them wrenching all the time and making those adjustments that they needed to go faster and, you know, potentially get a better result out of it. So that's definitely what you need to do, is you need to watch the track and adapt yourself to the track as early as possible, so you've got that time to make those adjustments to your car. And also, you know, line choice is a big thing there too. It's not necessarily just always about your car setup. It's line choice is big too, because, you know, your natural head space says, okay, hit the apex, you know, that's what your normal racing thing does in your head.
Yeah.
Whereas there you're like, well, no, I can't hit the apex here. I've got to run wide, because that square edge hole there is going to put me off into the pipe. So I need to run a little bit wider than normal. So trying to get that adjustment in your head is a big thing to make too, you know.
I'm guessing that over the course of, you know, once we get to sort of the long finals, you're actually adjusting throughout the race as well as the track continues to change. I mean, that seems to be the speed at which it changes.
Correct, yeah. And then, you know, obviously if you get past in those main events, that person's obviously found a better line than you. And it's the same. That's where it's obviously a similarity to big motorsports would come in, is that especially motocross, you're getting passed by a faster guy from behind you. So, okay, so where's he making up his time? Okay, well, he's run wide here. I've been going on the inside there the whole time. Look how fast he's been. Okay, so I'll adjust my line to suit that and then see if I can gain the speed back and pass him back and get the lead again. Things like that is you're always adapting. And this year, because they watered so much too, made that even worse, I found, because back in the day when they used to let it dry out a little bit more, it used to be more square edge bumps and the bump used to sort of stay where it was but just keep digging out and out and get deeper and deeper.
Okay.
Whereas now I've found that being that the track was so moist, it sort of tended to keep the hole more rounded but get spread across further, you know, it wasn't so square edges such as and sharp as what they used to be. It sort of more unsettled the car that much that, you know, you'd either get all squirrely or hit the pipe or not be able to make you jump or something like that, you know.
So tell me about the racetrack. You know, what was the layout? What was the general consensus and your kind of view of the layout? Which parts of the track did you, you know, really like? Which were the hardest to deal with? I think many of us will have seen the footage, but what's it like, you know, standing there with a transmitter in your hand?
Yeah, so basically with the track, the last 2 years have made the back section of the track built up, you know, probably 6 foot high. So it's actually made it sort of more of a 3D track.
Yep.
Not a lot of jumps this year. I think there's only three doubles this year, a little like sort of rhythm slash whoop section, I suppose you would call it.
Yep.
And the rest was more technical, you know, up and down the hill or, you know, sweeping corners and stuff like that, which, you know, I spoke to Joe about it and I said, oh, not a lot of jumps this year compared to previous years. And he's like, yeah, well, it's, you know, the track always gets so rough. You know, we keep having all these jump sections. We have to sort of fix them all up all the time just to try and make it so everyone can clear the jumps. And that's what we're all about, is we're all about air time and big jumps and stuff like that. But for here, we just thought this year we'll try it with less jumps so everyone's got a chance to do their lap without crashing.
Yep.
And then, you know, the track will slow down naturally once it starts getting bumps and rutted and holes. So we'll actually just let people, you know, pick the line and make line choice a thing rather than, you know, making a jump section instead. And I was like, oh, that's a good point. I actually thought it worked out really well.
Yep.
You know, it was a very flowing track. The big whoop section wasn't here this year. That's what it was last year, because it used to hit that, and I used to just, you know, hate hitting that section because, like, what's my car going to do this time? Is it going to fly off the track, or is it actually going to make it this time? Or whereas this year you could actually sort of pick your line and you know, you get a good lap in, you're like, hell yeah, that was a nice lap.
Yeah.
And then the next lap you know, mess up a little section or you hit a bump where you shouldn't have or something like that. But yeah, I thought it was quite a fun layout. It was one of the more fun layouts I've done with one of Joey's ones.
Was there a particular section of the track that you really enjoyed?
Probably up the back section where you can come down. Like up on the back right there was like you sort of step up the hill, turn around and then right hand down, like a little jump down.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got that right on the apex, it was actually a bit of a blind spot, I thought, from the driver's stand, because obviously you're looking straight at it from the driver's stand. That was actually good fun. You get that right and you turn left hand and it's like a little drop off there and you have the little rhythm section. So if you got that section right, that was really rewarding and fun.
Yeah. That rhythm section looked like it was pretty tricky and different in different classes, right? So the trucks went through there a bit more easily than the buggies. You're always kind of changing your driving depending on what car you have on track at any one time.
That's right. And then the buggies also sort of cupped out the up ramp of the first rhythm section there, that first up ramp of the rhythm section. So the first day, everyone was sort of running a little bit wider and wider there because it was getting cupped out. So you couldn't actually make that first double to go double through there. You have to just go single, single, single. So, but then as I thought, as the event went through the days, it actually stayed there like a nice up ramp. So I don't know whether that was just the track packing in and then once they fixed the track up that night, it sort of stayed that way. But I thought that was pretty tricky to get right, especially to go double and then hit the apex to get out to go up to the top hairpin there. But one of those sections, it was really rewarding to get it right for sure.
Now, we talked there about, you know, how the track is different in different classes, which, you know, raises that question of how many classes do you run? You ran four classes, both electric and nitro, truck and buggy in the pro division. That seemed to be a, you know, pretty, like, certainly a lot of the fast guys are all running three or four classes. Is that really just about getting as much track time as you can, or is it just that you really like racing all the different kind of categories? What's the reasoning behind running so many classes?
There's a few reasons, because obviously you've got, what, 3 or 4 hours in between each run. So yeah. if you can make that down to 1.5 or 2 hours between yeah. each run, you know, it's still, I think it still works out to be like 2 hours in between each run anyway, but it's more more track time for you, obviously, to do that. But as I said just before, previous years, the track was quite technical with the jump sections and stuff like that that he had. And having that extra track time would have made a massive difference on how, you know, how fast you can adapt to the track, especially from a person from overseas that, you know, is in that position. You need to be able to have that track time to gain the speed as and knowledge of what the local guys do from over there. So, yeah, I chose to run four classes, and I'm a big e-truggy guy these days anyway. So, for me, it was no drama taking the e-truggy over there and have a bit of a run with that. They're good fun, big power. But yeah, you really need to have that track time, at it, like especially at the dirt race or something like that, you know, where it's a very technical, big open track. You need to have that extra 5 minutes around of track time just to try and get on top of things.
So you do get really limited practice, don't you, at a race like this? I think it was, what, two or three quite short practice runs in each class? Is that how it was?
Yeah, so the first day is practice, which is the yep. Wednesday, and seeding. So pretty much as soon as you hit the car on that front straightaway and you cross the loop, you are yep. on the clock on the clock. Very first get-go.
Yep.
So it's the first day is seeding. So you run, that's the only day you run all four cars or three yep. cars, whatever classes you run, but you run all yep. your classes in that first day twice. And you get 4 minutes of practice per class. So you get 2 4-minute per truggy, yada, yada, down the other classes. Hmm. So I think in all, you get, 16 minutes of track time per round,
yep.
basically. And you're on the clock from the very first get-go. There is no first round, just sort of a bit, get your eye in sort of thing. You're on the clock. Yeah. and you're seeding. And generally in those events or these events, the first run is always the fastest because, as we talked yeah. about before, the track deteriorates and gets rough throughout the day, so your times actually go slower.
Yeah,
you know, so we had e-buggy first up, and that's all about just trying to learn the track. So it was a lot of people, that was a throwaway round, but at the end of the day, it wasn't really a throwaway round mm-hmm. because those two laps, because it goes by best two, not best yeah. three, like yeah. we do over here,
yeah,
actually your fastest time. So
yeah. So you've almost got two laps to learn the track and then go, on the clock, yeah, as you say.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, and then so the rest of the week, I mean, the schedule as we understand it, you know, it's qualifying for two classes a day, three rounds, and then the next day's qualifying for the other classes, and then it's finals and finals as we go. So first day of qualifying is, what, electric buggy and nitro truck? And then...
Yep.
We switch to electric truck and nitro buggy, and then we do finals. That's the general format of it, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, one of the questions I have for you is how does everyone get through the event? You know, like if I was reading the times on the results, right? You said we start at 7. Sometimes those last races weren't finishing until after midnight. That's 4 or 5 pretty solidly long days. How do you kind of prep yourself when you go to a big race like that to be able to cope just with the length of the days?
Well, I don't even know if you can really prep yourself for it, I suppose, but you try. Yeah. Obviously for me this year, beer got me through a lot of it, but you see a lot of the guys, they'll actually leave because, you know, you get an hour or two or three between each run. So depending on the day,
yeah,
you'll see a lot of guys, they'll leave, go back. That's the beauty about having it at a hotel, yeah. 3 minutes walk from your room, is you can go back, sneak back, have a quick sleep for an hour or two, have a shower and clean yourself up again and come back and have a go again. A lot of guys go to the pool because it's literally right next door to the pool.
Yep.
So you can go to the pool and have fall asleep on the cabana there, or have a quick swim and refresh off and come back. But yeah, it's one of those things, like, you know, again, the pro class, some of these pro guys have got to be there at 7 a.m. in the morning to marshal that very first race because yep. they're the last race of the day. So they got to be there from 7 a.m. in the morning until the very, very last race that night. So it's very, very hard work to do it, and trying to keep you focused the whole time like that as well. But you know, yeah, you just got to sort of try and adjust your time in your head to say, okay, well, I've got an hour free here. I need to go back and have a quick sleep and relax, or go grab some food and just get myself away from this shed for a little bit. You know, get some fresh air and grab a drink or whatever, and come back and go again.
Would be one of the special things about doing a race at a venue like that, as opposed to a, you know, a sports field in the middle of suburbia, you know, where we really are just kind of stuck there for the day.
Exactly. And that's one thing we sort of mixed up last year, was when we went over to Ty and Jacko Beale, is we actually got an Airbnb, which was 20 minutes from, you know, South Point Casino. Okay. So that ruined us. And we said this year, if we go again, we're definitely not going to do that again, because you'll finish at 1:30 in the morning or 2 a.m. and you've got still another 20-minute drive before you can actually get yourself to bed.
Staying on site. Must. Yeah, so is a must do. So there you go. For anyone that's considering going to the Silver State race next year, or any of the big hotel races that are on in the US, make sure you stay on site. Mate, let's get to talking about the racing itself. And I said at the top, you know, we don't necessarily want to kind of go through blow by blow on the results, but I wanted to ask, you know, having been there for the 5 days, what were the performances, the results, the particular races that caught your eye over the course of the week? So tell me a little bit about what you noticed as the sort of standout moments, and, you know, what you think's going on at that level.
I noticed that the young kids are very, very fast these days, and they're going to be forced to be reckoned with. You know, you look at Fee Long, he was leading a lot of the A main in the Pro Nitro Buggy class. He's 12 years old, you know, tiny little kid, and he's out there beating the pros that have been at the top of their game for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And he's just showing them how it's done, you know. Young kids like that, that was really cool to see and be a part of that. And I was fortunate enough to be there last year, where he put the pass in the last lap against Joe Bornhorst in the e-truggy main, which would go down in the history books as one of the best passes in RC history.
Won it.
You know, where he jumped over him and won that in the pro e-truggy class, you know.
It's just about
that kid's going to go far.
It's just about that pass and Reinhard V. Hara at the, what was it, 2006 Turinco Worlds. Yeah.
That's right. Now Chris Cross. Yeah, that was pretty cool too.
That's an interesting theme that I've been noticing a little bit lately, and talking about on a few of the shows, this notion of generational change. And I mean, Fee is he's the youngest almost of these kind of gun kids that are showing up, but all over the world, and it's true here in Australia as well, there seems to be this generational shift going on, certainly in 10th and 8th scale off-road, maybe less so in on-road. That's pretty evident, right, in someone like Fee, but were there some other young guns that, you know, that were kind of, you know, really push, you're starting to see really push forward? Someone like Mason Fuller, for example.
Yeah, that was going to be the next guy I was going to say. Yeah. Mason and Caden Fuller, the two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at a couple of years ago, they were sort of, you know, not even really making B mains and stuff like that at these big events. And, you know, all of a sudden they get these deals with HB, switch brands, and they just found a car and a setup that works for them. And look at Mason at PNB, you know, he won two of the pro classes there, I think. So to see him coming up and as fast as he's going now, like he's going to be, you know, forced to be reckoned with as well, and potentially a future world champion if he can keep his head in the game and keep going the way he's going, for sure. You know, you look at, you know, Dakota Fenn, you know, he had his struggles this week. He finally got the e-buggy win, which was cool to see. But then you look in the Nitro classes and, you know, everyone says that's why Nitro is a glory. You can have a simple flame out like that, and there's your race gone. You know, you got to have everything that on point and have a bit of luck behind you to actually get anywhere, you know.
So let's have a little chat about that Pro Nitro Buggy final. I mean, I was watching online. So, I mean, what I noticed, and let me test this to see whether what you saw in the room is different, because that sometimes is the case. Although Fenn did get away at the beginning, it seemed fairly obvious fairly quickly within the first couple of minutes that Barufalo had speed and Fee Long Nguyen had speed as well. And I actually kind of thought pretty early on that Fenn looked like he was going to have a real challenge on his hands. And then I guess once we saw him flamed out, he lost, 8 or 9 seconds, and at that first pit stop, really didn't regain any of that ground over the back sort of 30 minutes of that final. Did you notice that kind of speed of those two that ended up running first and second right from the start?
Oh, for sure. You know, like I was sat next to Gavin and we both said to each other, Fenn's in trouble here. Like, His car looks good, but the speed that Brouflo had, and I think obviously Fealong pushing him so hard as well, and then you got Mason pushing them two along. You know, they'll putting the pressure on and fend, and you know, you when you're a racer, you're on your track, and you look at the person behind you. You can always pinpoint yourself whether you're going down a straightaway or from a certain corner, the gap between yourselves to you know where you see where your pace is, or if they're catching you or not. You know, and I think he would have been looking at that in when he was obviously racing and saying, man, these guys are catching me here. What have I got to do to get fast? Like, where are they picking up this time to do what they're doing? You know, and then obviously he had that flame out, which put him back a bit, and then it was on for you, Brouflo and Fealong after that. And then, you know, Mason had a couple of little battles there as well, which was cool.
Because he'd come through from the B, he'd bumped up from the B final, hadn't he, Mason? So he'd started right down the back.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. I can't remember now, but yeah, I'm pretty sure he came back from the B.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he was just, yeah, played it cool and got through the lap traffic at the start pretty quickly. You know, I think Mayfield was in a bit of a struggle town there with his buggy with the techno he's got, but obviously Brouflo's got his down pat the way he likes it set up for that sort of condition. And I don't know if tyre choice was too big of a factor there this year, because everyone was on super soft from around the pits that I could tell anyway.
Yep.
And then, you know, they were doing all this funny stuff with cutting pins and Vs and the big trencher tyres, which I tried a few times and didn't really notice much difference either.
Yeah.
It was more just, I think, a compound / line choice sort of game, you know, and obviously making no mistakes.
Yeah. Brouflo taking that win, you know, that strikes me as being pretty significant. First big win for him, or certainly that I can recall, in the US, and a monster race to win. Do you think that's going to, I mean, you'd have to think he's going to go on with some real confidence through the rest of the season, even back home in Europe, and out of a big win like this and be pretty hard to stop?
Yeah, I think so. Like, that's the sort of race where you get your confidence about you. You know, it's almost, you know, they call it the indoor world championships. It went indoor world championships for a reason. And, you know, and he won that. Not, I wouldn't say comfortably. Obviously, Fealong gave him his run for his money. Yeah. But,
absolutely.
You know, for the normal Brouflo that I've seen race numerous times, and you watch him online and stuff like that, race is almost like a James Stewart in motocross. You know, he's win it or bin it. You know, he'll be full noise and will just crash off the track and just from driving so erratically. But this AMA that I watched him race, he just was so cool, calm and collected, but so ultra fast. You know, it was really cool to see that part of him come out, you know. And if he can keep that same mentality going into his next races coming up, he'll be up there knocking on the wins for sure.
Yeah. There did seem to be a real demand to drive with discipline, I think, in, you know, as you look at that racetrack. And that was one of the things that I noticed a few times with Fee through that A main, where he would get a little bit out of shape or offline, and instead of just, you know, like certainly I would have when I was 12, just pinning it and trying to kind of power out, he would take his medicine, calm the car down, get back on the line, and, you know, and go again. So there was a, you know, that almost more than the speed and the result for me was one of the things that impressed me most about his drive, the discipline that he kind of had as a 12-year-old, you know, on a really difficult racetrack to not compound one mistake with more. Just when he made a mistake, took his medicine, calmed down and got on with it.
Exactly, yeah, because the track at the end of the day is the one that's going to win, you know. If you attack the track, it'll bite you. So you need to be able to, you know, if you feel like the track's having a bit of a nibble at you and you're sort of dropping a bit above your head, then that's when you sort of need to take that deep breath and go, righto, I need to change my line here, or let's just take a step back. I'm going too fast. I'm pushing too hard. You know, I can see he's making mistakes, the guy in front of me. Let's just back it up a little bit, be consistent, bring the consistency game back into it, and we'll be right there.
Yeah. What else did you notice, Ben, as you were trackside and, you know, watching the finals and or over the course of the week? What were some of the other things you paid attention to?
It's more like your bigger name drives. You know, you look at Tebow. That was a bit of a bugger that he didn't make any of the A mains. I think he actually made the A main in the E buggy, I think it was, or. But yeah, he had a bit of a rough weekend, which is sad to see, because, you know, that was his last ever silver state. He's on his retirement run at the moment for this year, and to not make the A in pro buggy, or I think it was Truggy that he didn't make the A main either. But yeah, a couple of pro class A mains, that was pretty bad to see. Obviously, Mayfield went really good in the truck classes. Obviously, he won that. But then you look at him in buggy, he just seemed to struggle with that car all weekend. Don't know if it's the car or just him not being able to adapt his driving style to to suit that the buggy just yet. He's still got a bit of work to do with it. Or, you know, I know they get those guys are trying a lot of things at the moment with the car and parts and stuff like that. So I don't just don't know if it's just like a balancing thing that he couldn't get right to suit it the way he used to. But so that was a bit of a bugger to see him sort of mid pack in the A.
So let me kind of dive in there for a second and ask you about this, because, you know, I'm thinking about Tebow and Mayfield in particular, but there are others. Cavalieri is another example.
Yeah.
Of guys who have made a shift this season into a new car, a new chassis, new manufacturer. And, you know, those of us who, you know, watch on from a distance go, oh, look, how hard can it be really to change from, you know, one car to another? Or they're all pretty much the same. But Ben, give us, I mean, you've changed brands yourself over the last 12 months. Give us a bit of an insight into how hard it is at that elite level to shift from one manufacturer to another, from one almost design and setup philosophy to another, and how much kind of learning and relearning there is. Because I feel like we're seeing that play out with some of those guys at the moment. They're still trying to find their way, even, you know, 4 or 5 months into a new car. Is that really what it's like? What's your kind of observation and experience there?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what it's like. But you got to remember the team is a big part of it too. You know, the guys you're pitting with at these big events. You know, I'll use Mayfield for an example. You know, like him and Drake have had this relationship for many, many years from the old TLR days. You know, and then they sort of merged across to Mugen. They followed each other and did this thing. They've been together for, what is it, 10 plus years probably.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you leave your buddy or your marriage sort of thing, you suppose you'd call it.
Yeah.
And then you're going into this wide open thing, whereas, you know, I sort of thought about it, well, that is a massive change. It's not just the car you're changing your whole team.
Yeah.
You know, like the people around you is all different. And, you know, so you're chasing money at the end of the day because that's what pays the bills. But it's one of those things, like he had, you know, Tanner Denny and all those guys that he used to hang around with, his local Arizona guys that were all on his team, and now he's just literally out on his own.
Yeah.
So the whole team part of it, I think, makes a big difference on how you interact with yourself. And obviously, he's still got Truey there helping him, pitting for him. But yeah, the adaptation to a car is a big thing as well. Like, he's gone from a pillow ball car to a C-Hub car. And then I've gone the opposite way myself. I've gone from a C-Hub car where I've only ever ran C-Hub cars to now a pillow ball with the S-Works cars. It's a big change, the way they drive, you know, the way the front sort of squats and handles the bumps differently and stuff like that. It's a big adaptation you got to, you know, work towards and get yourself set up and the way the car drives. And, you know, I just think with Mayfield at the moment, he's just got a little bit of work to do with the buggy to get it the way he needs it. You know, obviously there's nothing wrong with the buggy because Brufalo just went and won that race himself.
There you go. So
there's nothing wrong with the buggy. It's just about getting himself comfortable with it and adjusted to it to suit himself.
Yeah, so we're talking there about not just a design and setup philosophy, but you've raised that kind of about the whole ecosystem. And I guess then I go, you know, I'm always making these flights of fancy and these strange connections, but I think about someone like Daniel Ricciardo in, you know, in F1 and his struggles to adapt to the McLaren, which are so well publicized and resulted in, you know, finishing that contract early. But there's almost a similar thing, isn't there? There's a whole different design and setup philosophy, a whole different ecosystem around him as a driver and the team that just proved to be too big a hurdle. And I think we're seeing people like Mayfield, Tebow, Cavalieri, some of these guys who have been household names, you know, for two decades, just going through that same process of different setup and design, different way the car needs to be driven. And as you've really, that's been a really helpful observation for me that, you know, you've made there about the system, the ecosystem, the team, the environment, you know, is another thing to learn. And really we're only, you know, what, 4 months in, 4 or 5 months in for those guys with their new team. So I think that's one of the things to watch for over the you know, rest of 2023, as to how those guys keep evolving and developing with those teams. And then on top of that, we put that generational shift that we talked about earlier. And, you know, we know Tebow. I had Jared on the show just a few weeks ago, and he talked a lot about the kind of reasoning at this stage of his life as he kind of has made this decision. But there's all these, the kids are coming, as we've talked about as well.
Yeah, and I think the way these kids play these computer games and that these days, you know, it's pretty much just putting it into real life, or they can play their shoot 'em up games or race car games on the computer so fast and well these days. It's once they get stuck in RC, it's once they get the setup down pat or find a car they like and work well with, they're there. You know,
is there also a fearlessness to the driving? You know, when you're 12, 13, 14, and maybe you don't depend on winning races to make money to pay your mortgage or buy your groceries, maybe there's a bit of a fearlessness about the way that you can drive free from any real sense of stress or pressure.
Yeah, that's another big thing, because I'll use Mayfield again for an example. He's got a family now with kids, as do I. Not that I do this for a living, but it's one of those things that's those guys are there racing for their wage. They need those wins. They need those bonuses that they get from those wins from all their sponsors to help pay their bills and keep their food on the table for their family.
Yeah.
And then, obviously age comes into it as well. These guys are, 35 years old or whatever now, I personally don't even have those reflexes I used to do anymore. I struggle to get to the track two or three times a month, let alone these kids that, I'll use Jacko Beale for an example. He's at every club day for Logan. He's at Pine Hills every Wednesday practicing. He's at a Thursday practice.
Yeah.
It's stuff like that. Guys like myself and those guys just can't compete with that, That's where the difference and the swing of these young guys is going to come in, and the guys that can put in the time and the effort.
You've named a few Australians there, and we'll come back and talk about those guys in just a minute about how things went for them over there. Wanted to just check in with you on a couple of other things. Electric truck seems to be a class that's growing in popularity, certainly here in Australia, but around the world as a club class. For the first time this week, we really saw a big whack of the pros run that class as well. Tell me about what you're noticing about the growth of electric truck racing. Is this a genuine move toward the class? Do you think it's going to keep growing the way that it has?
I think it is going to be a genuine growth. I think there's a bit of a swing at the moment for guys that would, deep down like myself, that love truggy, that will go, okay, well, there's no one that ever runs nitro truck at my local track, but there's one or two guys that will run electric trucks, so I might get one to dabble in, and before you know it, you're racing big events in it and things like that. But in America, you still get a lot of guys that are on the fence. I speak to a lot of the pros over there, and a lot of them are like, oh, you're running that hillbilly class, and that's for the old guys, and what are you running that crap for? And then you look at the bigger guys that need to do it for the track time, or the company they work for is wanting to have that that fast guy out there and running their card and try and put it on the top as well, as a bit more of a promotional thing. But I personally think it'll, give it another year or two, it'll definitely be a big class for a lot of people that run electric only. Paul Mason's one of those guys from Australia that went over to Silverstone. He didn't even take a nitro car with him. He just took his two electric cars and ran four classes. He ran over 40s and then Sportsman in the other two. And that gave him his four classes that he needed to get the extra track time that he needed, just running purely electric. So, not like at the end of the day, nitro is the glory and nothing will ever beat it or trump it, I don't think. But I think the numbers for electric in general are going to keep on growing because, battery and electronic technology is getting better and better. And people are more wary of that sort of stuff nowadays.
We do seem to have reached a point over the last few years where the motor and speed control kind of challenges of the past are largely gone as well. Things are fairly reliable and almost bulletproof now as well, aren't they? So electrics become relatively plug and play, kind of, not really the challenges that there were, say, 10 years ago where the electronics were still a bit of an issue.
Exactly, yeah. And then, like I said, battery technology has come a long way. So you can get 15, 20 minutes out of a battery, even in an electric truck, So, they're pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as a guy who grew up racing electric, I certainly enjoy racing electric 8-scale. I'd love to run nitro as well if someone else worked on the car, tuned the motor. Not skills that I have. Anything else before we go on to talk about the Australian and New Zealand contingent and some kind of have a bit of a look at how they went? Anything else that you kind of picked up over the course of the week that we should have a chat about?
Not really. No. Obviously Cavalieri went pretty well with his WRCs. He had a sort of a breakthrough event with those, which is cool. Not really. It's pretty much what you see on Live RC about these days is, you know, their coverage is pretty good. So nothing really behind the scenes that was going on that I can really share or whatever.
I think that shout out to Cavalier is a good one. It, you know, it externally seems like it's been a pretty challenging start to the year for him, both in 8-scale and in 10-scale, where he's made the move to WRC and Schumacher respectively. Had a solid weekend at the indoor cup at 10-scale nationals just a couple of weeks ago, and then a pretty strong silver state, I thought, for him, and those cars starting to look better and better. So maybe we'll be able to look forward, you know, over the next few months to seeing, well, the US nationals just a couple of weeks away in 8-scale as well. So maybe we'll see Cav starting to demonstrate why he is one of the greatest of all time as he gets to grips with those cars.
Yeah, definitely. That Raw Nationals over there in the next couple of weeks is going to be a good one to watch.
Yeah, it will be one to look forward to for sure. All right, let's talk about the Australian and New Zealand crew. We listed a whole bunch of them off before yourself. Caleb Noble, Alex Bernardzik, Paul Mason, Mark Andrew, Gavin White, I think you said, the Australians, and Jaden Jamieson from New Zealand. How did everybody, well, firstly, did everyone have a good time? Do you think they'd go back again? How was the vibe among that crew from down under?
The vibe would have been, it's always positive because you're overseas racing toy cars.
Hmm.
So you're over there, you know, for a vacation as well. But I think for Alex and Peter, they sort of had a bit more expectations. Me personally, I expected him to go a little bit better than what he did.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a shame, but you know, you're playing against the big boys over there.
Yeah.
You know, so everything needs to be 110%. You need to be on your game as soon as you hit that track for that very first time. And you know, I understand that he would have had a few nerves and stuff like that, being that it's his first international race and whatever else. So, you know, I think he can hold his head high with the way he finished the event. I think it's just at the end of the day, it was the length of the event, but the length of the days you're there sort of took its toll on them. And myself personally, I thought the days were just too long with that many entries.
Yeah.
It was a big event, you know, and I come back and I just said to my wife, I said, I need a holiday, you know.
Hang on, you went for a holiday.
Yeah, I went for a holiday, yeah. But just very, very long days, you know. You literally get no time to go and sightsee or anything like that. So, you know, but Alex had a good run in the end. He sort of got his head in the game and his car sorted towards the end and was knocking on the door of a bump spot there into the B main for a while. So he bumped out of the D main with me and was sort of making his way up through the C main to get a B spot main. But I had a couple of little unfortunate mistakes towards the end, I think. So, but he went well, you know, he showed his speed and I think Associated were really happy with the way he went over there and conducted himself and everything, him and Peter. So that was good. And then Caleb, he actually went really well. He had a little bit of a slow start as well, but sort of come on strong once he, you know, again got his head in the game, got his car sorted to suit the conditions and found a tyre that he liked. He went really well. He was, I think he finished just ahead of Alex in the C main there and just behind him was Jaden Jamieson from New Zealand. So it's funny how all of us guys, we travel across the other side of the world to race and we always end up in the same bunch together. It's just
to race against each other.
It's just funny how that always works out that way. But I think Jaden Jamieson, he made the bump spot from the B in the electric truck main to get into the A, which is that was awesome. So he's come a long way, Jaden Jamieson, and so is Caleb Noble. The way they can conduct themselves at a race meet like that at that high level and you know, just slot right in with their team and make the adjustments and, you know, run the way they do, because from a person looking from the outside in, it's really cool to see how they can adapt themselves so quickly and drive so well like they do.
So just before we leave those guys and just check in on Paul and Mark and Gavin, I think it's worth, you know, certainly for those from outside Australia who might be checking into the show, it's a bit of a reset going on here in 8-scale in Australia, isn't there, with Kyle McBride seemingly but unconfirmed to kind of have hung up the transmitter, at least for the moment. He certainly hasn't been seen on any racetracks. And Bernardzik has been the heir apparent really for the last couple of years, but Caleb Noble has been coming on very strong. And I think we're going to see those two guys go pretty hard at it over the next couple of years with some other young guys, you know, kids like Jack Parsi and you know, the Beale kind of crew that you've talked about, and there are others as well. But I think we're going to see Caleb Noble and Alex Benazic go pretty hard at it, potentially at the Australian Nationals later this year, but even at that Asian Buggy Championship race in just a couple of months' time.
Yeah, definitely. And you don't need to look at the work that those two kids put into their program and understand why they're at the level they are. You know, they're literally living and breathing it. And then work on their cars day in and day out and making sure that they're good to go 110% of the time. So, I think the next Nationals and, you know, let's all hope that it's not the end of Kyle McBride, but yeah. From the sounds of it, it might be that the case. That's maybe it's time to crown a new Australian champion and start another chapter in Australian RC racing. But I think they're definitely going to be Alex and Caleb going to be up there for fighting for the wins for the next few of them. They're definitely on another level than anybody else at the moment. And as you mentioned, Jack Parsi and Jack O'Beale and stuff like that. The maturity will come with those young kids and stuff like that. But yeah, so I just think at the moment the level that Alex and Caleb are at, they're definitely at the top of their game and still got a bit more improvement to do. You know, if you're going to do some more international races, that'll make them even faster again.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and there's some young speed in Western Australia and South Australia as well. There's a real generational shift going on here. And for those of us who've been around for a few years, it's pretty exciting to see, you know, a different lineup starting to emerge at the front of 8-Sky Racing in Australia. Now, Paul and Mark and Gavin, how did their events go over there?
Gavin, he went really well. He made two of the A-mains in the two classes he won. He ran the most classes out of anybody. He ran six classes. So he's a busy man, and I was a busy man with him as well because I had to pit for him every single time. But there was a few times there I was wondering, like, where's your fuel tank? I couldn't even see straight. But, yeah, I made it happen for him, and we got there in the end.
So was he running some of the age-based classes as well?
Yeah, so he went over with a nitro truck, electric buggy, and nitro buggy.
Okay.
So three classes, then you run those three in sportsman, then he also ran over 40s in those three as well. So it's six classes in total. So the first day was a busy one, that's for sure. And then, so he went well. He made two of the A-mains, and he came back pumped. He was ready to go again. So I'm pretty sure you'll see his name pop up again next year at the Silver State. So
sign him up.
And possibly even the Lone Star Challenge. He's thinking about staying over there for the extra two weeks and doing that race over in Texas. So that'd be pretty cool.
Yep.
And then, Paul went well. He made both A-mains in his classes as well.
Yep.
He was knocking on the door of a podium in one of the races, had a couple of mistakes and fell back a spot or two. But and then Mark Andrew went real well. He top qualified his nitro buggy class, I think, that he ran. He was leading that and then had a – don't ask me how wide his car this way, but anyway, his receiver plug came out. Sort of midway through leading the A-main, and then obviously put him back a fair few laps and couldn't recover after that, but that was a bit of a bugger. But I think at the end of the day, there's sort of those three guys that have walked away pretty proud with their results. It's a sportsman class, but still it's a class, mate. They're there to race. They're racing against their ability and guys of their ability. That's right, their peers. And then, to finish the way they did was that was awesome to see.
Fantastic. Great job from the Down Under crew. And we talked about Jaden, that, he's, his results have been kind of really kicking along as well, haven't they? And I hope we get to see him in Australia at a couple of the big races. I haven't gone through the results or the entries for the Asian Buggy Championships to see if he's coming over for that, but would love to see him and Alex and Caleb going out. I think that's the nickname, is that right? Apologies, Caleb. damn it. How about you, Ben? How'd your race go? Tell me about the choice between running pro and intermediate for you. Like, you choose to run in the pro class against the best guys in the world. Is that why you just want to be in there with that that elite level and kind of measure yourself there? What's your kind of choice there?
Well, Joe's obviously got a pretty strict rule in place for pro guys or intermediate guys. If you get any product at 100% discount, so free, you're not allowed to run the intermediate class. Okay. So obviously I fall under that category, which is annoying, but it's just the way it goes.
Also nice. That support. Yeah.
Yeah, that, exactly right. Yeah, I'll never complain about it, that's for sure. So I'm very fortunate that I got that opportunity to be in the pro class. But like, as I said, I never went over there for results. Previous years, yes, I have. At DNC, where I've made a couple of C mains and stuff like that, where I've sort of done pretty well. Yeah, I had a good event. It was more of like for me trying to get used to my cars. I've only run them for this part of this year too. So working with Joe Bornhorst and stuff over there was good because they could give me a bit more of an insight on the car and simple things like the shocks. Just I went over there running what I normally would run and it was good in California. And then all of a sudden we go there and they're like, "Man, your car's just way too hard." So then we're playing around with shocks and stuff like that, trying to get it right. And yeah, once I sort of finished qualifying and stuff like that, I sort of let my hair down after that. I sort of knew I wasn't really gonna in the run to make the B main or A main. And so it was more just, yeah, I enjoyed myself after that. So I had fun. Always come back with learning heaps and love driving on tracks like that. So, it's a whole sort of promotion of the event over there on how big it is and watching the pros race the way they do and everything like that being a part of it. But I think if I was to go next year, I would sort of definitely try and run intermediate and, enjoy myself. But to be honest, I can't see myself going back for a couple of years yet. It's very, very expensive in the USA at the moment. Like we went to a Dodgers game over there, and just for two beers at the Dodgers game was $63 Australian.
Oh,
Yeah,
gosh.
so
I'll
my
just.
beer was $31.50, and I definitely made sure it lasted a long time too. Enjoyed it.
Mate, just out of those things you've said there, two questions I want to ask you. One is, for you personally, but so let's kind of broaden this out and extrapolate. For people who go to a race meeting like this, who make the effort to kind of travel across the world or across the country to do a big race, how valuable is that learning experience? And for you, for example, do you come home with some new insights into the car setup? You talked about, softening up the car or the way you drive that you think you'll be able to apply at home. Is it a As well as being fun to be there, does it kick your driving and your performance along when you come home?
Yeah, it does because it gives you a big confidence boost too. You can say you've been to the other side of the world or the USA racing against the world's best that, all these guys at your local event that you're racing at over here have never been to, have only ever seen on TV. So, you can sort of, walk into an event or race into an event over here and be like, "Well, I mean, I can race against these world-class guys. These guys are nobodies to me in, so to speak." And just to try and give yourself that confidence to do better. And back when I was going there two or three times a year racing, when I was racing in Victoria, I was on top of my game down there. I barely ever lost, it's just one of those things. You can always bring that information back with you. You can bring the parts back. People can't get over here, things like that, that always give you that sort of upper hand against the local guys over here. So yeah, obviously product availability in Australia is not always the same as what it is in America. There's a lot of parts you can get in America that you can't get here or as easy, So, to being able to go over there and get everything you need and bring it back and then set yourself up for the season ahead is really cool too.
Nice. Let's talk for a moment about S-Works. That's the company that you are driving for, and it's a brand. I guess I'm just curious about the kind of emergence of S-Works as a competitive force. They really have kind of come on strong in the last almost the last 2 or 3 years, almost out of COVID. They've built a bigger team. The cars have developed and developed. You've been on board with them for a little while. What are you kind of thinking and observing about the future for S-Works in terms of being a globally competitive race team?
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously they're not as mainstream as your big three that are in the world, but they're definitely knocking on the door of that. The quality of their car is awesome. I can't fault it. Obviously, with any 8-scale buggy, whether it's one of the big three or not, you still have to build your car. It's not just a matter of all these cars don't come out of the box; you just slap them together and race. There's always
Damn
things you need to do to them. It'd be nice if you could, but unfortunately, it's not the case. You always need to make sure your arms are free, and obviously, 8-scale off-road, you need your suspension to be the best part of it. So, you need to make sure your suspension's all free and things like that. But the one of my favorite things about the S-Works is actually the diffs do not leak, and it is
Okay.
so good. I could leave my diffs sitting in there for 3 or 4 weeks before I go and run it again. Crack open the gearbox, and the diff still hasn't dropped a mill of oil. So.
Beautiful.
That's really good. The quality of their gears are all good. All the hardened steel products are all good, and the plastics are good. So, and it's good they're always evolving it. You know, like it's, you know, every few weeks you see there's something new about the car, or you know, they've got the new Worlds kit out now, which is what everybody's using. And it's good to see a company sort of, you know, adapting to what they need to be in the market for the whole world, not just their local track in Asia or something like that. That's, yeah, they listen to everybody from around the world and make changes as they need to. So they'll definitely be one of the big three or big four pretty soon, I think. You know, you look at Knaas and how he's going over in Europe at the moment. I think he just top qualified that IBC race over there, and he's flying with it. So
It is one of the cool things I think about 8 Scale at the moment is that there are so many good quality race cars available. And the same, you can extend that to tires. I mean, I did a count recently with a friend, and we got to 20 different tire brands that are kind of running around. And maybe that, you know, that makes things a bit complicated. But on the chassis side, to know that there's kind of half a dozen or more, you know, good quality, decent, competitive, well-built, reliable sort of options is a pretty nice thing. And S-Works have put themselves firmly in the middle of that over the last couple of years.
Yeah, for sure.
Mate, where to from here for you? I think we talked about Toowoomba, the race up there on the mountain just west of Brisbane in a couple of weeks' time. Asian Buggy Championships coming up. How are you feeling about the rest of your season?
Yeah, so we've got the King of the Mountain. That's in the next couple of weeks. That's always a good fun event up in Toowoomba. It's always a cold one, but it's always a fun one.
Toowoomba in winter.
Yeah, she's cold up on top of the mountain up there, that's for sure. And then so we've got that one, and then a month or two later we've got the Asian Buggy Championships held by the Pine Hill Race track, which is the big Scotty event. Scotty Ernst from over in the USA is coming over to run that one, which is awesome. And if you haven't signed up for it yet, do it soon, because I know they're capping the entries again. I think they just raised it to another 20, so 220 entries. So if you haven't signed up, I'd be signing up if I was you, and even just go get yourself an electric buggy to race for the event or whatever, but just be a part of it, because it's going to be one of the biggest races Australia's seen in a long time.
I did
So that one,
I did the Scotty Ernst Asian Touring Car Championship race at Brendale in Brisbane a couple of months ago. Borrowed a car to be there, and it was a fantastic event. And if the Asian Buggy Championship race is anything like that, as you say, it's not one to be missed. So whether you can buy or borrow or find a car from somewhere that you can race, get an entry in, come along and join us. I'll be there running electric buggy, and I think over 45 electric buggy, something like that. So come and race with me down in the C final. We'll have a wonderful time. And you, of course, Ben, will be running all sorts of cars in all sorts of classes at that event.
Yeah, I'm going to try and run obviously nitro buggy is my main class, and then I'll try and run the electric truck again in the electric truck class, just to have a double in that again, which is what I'll try and do for a bit of fun aside from the serious nitro buggy class.
Great. Mate, any closing thoughts from you on the Silver State experience that we've not kind of captured on the way through?
Just Silver State's one of those events. You know, if there's someone out there that's, you know, always wanted to go to the USA, haven't worked out what event they want to go to, you know, DNC or PNB or all that sort of stuff, as a person that travels from overseas that races over there, I would highly, highly recommend the Silver State race. They're talking about next year of capping the entries at 900, I think it is. So they're below the 1,000 mark, just to try and save a few heats for the day, to try and get it out of there a bit earlier. But even if not, you know, just go there and witness it. You know, it's an indoor race, you're guaranteed to race. You're in Vegas, you can go and see all the shows, spend another few days thereafter to recoup and enjoy Las Vegas, or get there a couple of days earlier, either. And you know, it's only a 4-hour drive from LA, so you can go to LA first and run some laps there, or just go straight to Vegas, race, and then go back to LA for a bit of a holiday, whatever you want to do. But yeah, I highly recommend the Silver State
Nice.
race to do it. You know, it's good.
Outstanding. I'd love to do. I would genuinely love to do one of those big races. Maybe this podcast will be big enough one day that I can go and do some interviews live and have an excuse to go race, but it would be fun. Ben, thank you so much for taking some time on a Sunday night to kind of sit and chat with me and dig back into the story, some of the stories of the Silver State race. Can't possibly capture all of it in an hour, but thanks heaps for joining me on the show.
No dramas at all, Scotty. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
maybe we'll do it again. We've got some other things to talk about. Folks, for today, that's it. We will be back with our more regular kind of interview style shows next week. A couple of other notes, a couple of events coming up. We talked about that Asian Buggy Championship, a couple of other Australian events of note. The Chargers RC 110 Scale Carnival in Southeast Queensland, first weekend in July. Entries are still open for that, and it's an entry capped event as well. And I just today spoke to the organisers of the Vintage Bash, the biggest vintage RC race in Australia, looking at attracting something like 200 cars to Melbourne, the Knox racetrack, later in the year, first weekend in November. I'll be there to enjoy the fun. And if you have got an old car or can put your hands on one, let me encourage you to come and join us for that. Just finally, thank you for the feedback we've continued to receive. People enjoying the show from all around the world. It's much appreciated. And as I said at the top of the show, if you want to give us any feedback about this kind of a show, something different for us, a bit of a race recap, we'd love to hear from you. That's it for now. Thanks for joining us, and we will be back next week.